You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's not unusual for parents to keep secrets from their children, especially when they're troubling stories from their past. Emma Brox had a feeling that her mother, Paula, was keeping secrets from her. She knew that her mother had been raised in South Africa and didn't just simply choose to leave for England one day in 1960, but she only had an inkling of what had caused her to leave. Following her mother's death, Emma investigated her mother's life in South Africa, uncovering stories of violence and sexual abuse at the hands of her mother's father that culminated in attempted murder. She describes her search for the details of that story in She Left Me the Gun, My Mother's Life Before Me. It's published by Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Emma Brox to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
You write in your preface that you didn't want your mother to be portrayed as a survivor. Why is that?
She was very prickly about the way that she was perceived, and she put everything into this notion of herself as a very happy, joyful, witty, spirited person, and she shrank away from the idea of victimhood. And I think she felt that embracing survivordom somehow entailed admitting to once having been a victim. So she was kind of odd about that.
Well, odd and rare, because most people who have been subjected to the kinds of things she was subjected to wind up being traumatized for the rest of their lives.
That's right. And also, I mean, you know, she in this day and age, she could have gotten a healthy sort of social dividend from it in a way. She could have worn her scars on her sleeve and basically been given a free pass for the rest of her life. But she decided not to trade on her early injuries.
And became a very strong person. She has a really strong personality.
Very
insists
strong.
That you have one as well.
I'm a pale imitation of her. She had a very strong personality, and she stood out in that she you know, I grew up in a very mild English village where there was, you know, no crime, barely a raised voice, and then my mother, you know, used to cruise around this village like a tank looking for fights. I mean, she was kind of a fish out of water.
How was she with your father?
She was great. I mean, they were complete opposites. My dad is a very nice, quiet Englishman. I think he got three words in during the course of a 27-year marriage, but it seemed to work okay.
She raised you in England, lived there most of the rest of her life after she'd left Africa, but she refused to identify herself as English.
She did. I mean, the thing about my mum is that she was a real contrarian. So while she was growing up in South Africa, all she did was pine for England. She read Austen, she read the Brontes. She was obsessed with the idea of London. And then after emigrating to England in 1960, she never had a good word to say about the British for the rest of her life.
Why would she continue to identify with a country that had wronged her so deeply?
I don't know. I think, like I say, she was a contrarian. She liked to be, you know, different from the people around her. And, you know, she always claimed that she found the British hellishly passive-aggressive, whereas she was aggressive-aggressive. I think it gave her a kick, you know.
She would always tell you, one day I will tell you the story of my life and you will be amazed. But she never got around to telling you the whole thing.
She didn't. She gave me a skeletal outline during the last month of her life. She tried to do something which I thought only existed in fiction, which was to have a deathbed conversation with me. But she was quite theatrical, my mum, so she tried to get one off the ground. And she gave me the bare bones of the story about her father, this terrible psychopath who had, you know, terrorized she and her siblings.
And despite the fact that she, you describe her as the world's worst holder of secrets, she did hold this secret pretty much to the end. Do you think she was trying to protect you?
Absolutely. It was my mother's sort of greatest ambition in life that she not pass down the trauma of her own childhood to my childhood. And to that end, I think she thought that she shouldn't even speak of it to me.
Well, she had a cleaned up version of the story, didn't she?
She did. She had a lot of jolly, like when she talked about Africa, she had a lot of jolly tales about, you know, the weather and the wildlife, which when I came back to look at it, I realized were a proxy for what was actually going on. I mean, like animals in her stories were always killing people. But of course, in the real version, it wasn't an animal.
Well, children are always curious about their grandparents. What did she tell you when you asked about them?
Well, the whole of her family was so far removed and so absent that they weren't pressing very heavily on my consciousness when I was growing up. Her father was dead by the time she came to England, and her mother had died when she was two. So, you know, it was natural that she didn't particularly want to speak about them.
When did you get the whole story?
After flying to Johannesburg, 6 months after her death, I decided that the only thing to do was to go to South Africa for the first time and to meet these seven half-siblings that I had never met before and try and find out precisely what my mother hadn't been telling me.
And also looking at court documents, was this a newspaper story?
It wasn't, but it helped me to pretend that it was. I mean, I think there's a... the journalistic persona was quite helpful in distancing me from some fairly lively material concerning my mum. So, yeah.
But all the court documents remain.
They do, in an archive in Pretoria. Extraordinary record-keeping abilities. A trial transcript from 1958 or 1957 is on record in Pretoria, and I managed to go and turf it out and read the testimony of my mother and her siblings, which was a hair-raising afternoon.
Because she brought charges of incest and rape against her father, Jimmy, your grandfather.
She did, and it was extraordinary in 1958 in South Africa to get those charges taken seriously. I mean, I think she spent years campaigning for the authorities to look into what was going on in their home. But, of course, you know, in that era in South Africa, it was very difficult to get the cops to show an interest.
And had you had any inkling of the incest part of the story?
I sort of had. I mean, after this all came to light, I went back and raked through my childhood memories to try and figure out what I knew sort of subtextually, sort of. And, you know, it was kind of there in my mother's responses to things. So, for example, she would always massively overreact to child sex abuse storylines on TV shows. If there was a, you know, CSI-type show, my mum would be hurling abuse at the television while my dad and I sat sort of uncomfortably. And the other thing she would do, and I have to give my mum credit for this, she was very good at turning all her neuroses into a finely honed comic routine, so she didn't freak me out. So whenever I left the house, instead of saying bye to me, she would say, as a mantra, don't get kidnapped, don't get abducted, don't get raped and murdered. That was just the thing she said to me every time I left the house.
Well, that could weigh heavily on a kid's imagination.
But I just thought it was funny. I just thought it was shtick. And I would always say to her, Ma, I'm only going to the shop. And she would say, you know, whatever. We would have this to and fro, and it never occurred to me that there might actually be some dreadful secret behind it all.
My guest is Emma Brox, who writes for The Guardian's Weekend magazine, has contributed to The New York Times, Vogue, Harper's Bazaar, and Elle, and is the winner of two British Press Awards, Young Journalist of the Year and Feature Writer of the Year. She's written a kind of a memoir, because mm-hmm. it's really as much a memoir of your mother as it is of you, called She Left Me the Gun, and she did leave you the gun.
She did. Well, it was her intention always to leave me the gun. This gun that she smuggled into Britain in 1960, wrapped in a pair of knickers, stuffed at the bottom of her trunk, and which she always felt getting through customs undetected was her first triumph against the British, and was in my house as I was growing up. And my mum eccentrically thought was exactly the kind of item you should leave to your daughter.
Well, there's a rule in movies. If you show a gun, you have to shoot it. But let's wait a little while to shoot it. How long did your mother live with her father?
I think she was still at home into her late teens and possibly into her early 20s.
Did anybody try to stop the abuse? How aware were other members of the family, her mother, her other siblings?
Her mother had died when she was two, and she had a stepmother.
Yeah.
And her stepmother was only 17 when she married my mother's father, so she was a very sort of weak and enfeebled character by the time that her, you know, ninth child was born. So it really was my mum who stood up to him more than anybody.
And her stepmother, actually testified in Jimmy's behalf at the trial. That was a really important part of the testimony.
It was. It was my mum. The thing that my mum was bitterest about was that the reason that the trial ultimately collapsed is that her stepmother lost her nerve at the 11th hour and changed her testimony to support her husband against her children. Extraordinary thing to do.
He was brought to trial by your mother, but he was found not guilty. He represented himself?
He did. Absolutely unbelievably, at the time, a man charged with child abuse was permitted to defend himself and to cross-examine his own children in open court and destroy them one by one, which is what he did.
Well, he knew how to intimidate them. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been in this situation in the first place. But he was also a dangerous character. Did it not matter to people that he'd been charged with murder before he had married your grandmother?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that fact didn't seem to have come to light during the trial, and none of my mother's siblings knew about it. I'm not even sure my mum knew about it. It came up during the course of my research that he had served part of a life sentence for murder before meeting my grandmother. She certainly didn't know about it, or else she would never have left my two-year-old mother in his care.
How much of all of this is a reflection of the Afrikaner culture of the time, the 1950s, in a mining community?
Well, I have to be careful not to over egg that or over generalize, but the context in which my mum's family grew up was one of rampant alcoholism and casual violence. So I've just been on book tour in South Africa, and after every event I did, you know, women of my mother's age would come up to me from these communities and say, that was my family. So I don't think it was hugely unusual.
You met with some of your mother's half-siblings in South Africa. How have they been affected by what happened to them when they were growing up?
So my mum was the oldest of eight children, and each of them displays, I would say, different types of post-traumatic stress disorder. If you were to let a psychologist loose in a room with these people, I think, you know, they would get many volumes out of it. They're all fantastic, terrific. They are also all, in their own way, strenuously peculiar, I would say.
Did they testify against their father at the trial?
Most of them did, yes, including a six-year-old.
So what happened after the trial? Could they still live with him?
They were put in a children's home for a short while, and then he was permitted to move back into the family home, and I think that was the ultimate trigger for my mother's emigration. She at that point, she was like, enough with this, I'm leaving.
She said she had two choices, never to be intimidated again, but also she wanted to try to be happy.
Yes, that was her condition for going on living. My mother sort of worked up this...
Because she thought about suicide?
She did. In the days after the trial collapsed, she told me in this last conversation I have with her that she had two options. She could kill herself or she could carry on living.
Did her half-siblings sympathize with her decision to leave?
Yes, they were incredibly supportive. I mean, she was more like a parent to them than a sibling, but they understood that she had done absolutely everything in her power, including trying to kill their dad, and that she was owed, you know, the right to be happy.
There's that gun.
Right.
She shot him five times, but didn't kill him.
No, she was rather
hopeless. Was he a bad shot?
Yeah, she was obviously absolutely rubbish at it. She should have gone to a firing range in advance and practiced. I imagine she'd had a couple of drinks to get the nerve up. Her brother told me that they found four of the bullets and they couldn't find two. So they assumed, as he put it, that the old man was carrying lead. But unfortunately, he survived.
Well, but only for a short time.
Yes. Then he
did the shooting have an effect on him? Is it one of the reasons he died?
I don't think so. He died ultimately of a brain hemorrhage, which was probably brought on by alcoholism and drug abuse.
Now, your mother showed you that gun when you were a child. How did she explain it?
She said she had one because when she would always assume a very jaunty air when she was talking about the gun. And she said the reason she had one was that everybody had one in Johannesburg when she was growing up. And she presented it to me as a sort of very glamorous accessory, which she very much hoped that I would have one day.
But then she ended up turning the gun into the police.
That's right. If I was being strictly literal, the title of this book should be, she really wanted to leave me the gun, but actually handed it into an amnesty at the last minute. When gun licensing became a big issue in the 90s, my mum got very nervous that I would get into trouble for having an unlicensed firearm. So she gave it into the local police station, yes.
But wouldn't it also have been a way to try to get rid of some bad memories?
I guess so, but I think she thought of the gun as a positive symbol of her efforts to take control of a situation and to actually do something to stop this man. So I think it held kind of good symbolic value to her, not bad.
What's your position on attempted murder? Do you think your mother should have gotten away with it?
Which she did. Yes. I mean, I think if she had killed him, I think she would have had a very strong self-defense. I'm very glad she didn't kill him because I think psychologically that would have been extremely difficult for her.
Emma Brock's book, She Left Me the Gun, My Mother's Life Before Me, is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks.